Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Tuesday Night with New Realities. My name is Zachary Fetter, and I'm going to be your guest host for this evening. And indeed, for next Tuesday, for a very special two-part show. Yes, it is a double bill, and for good reason. I've been wanting to do this show for a long time now, because I'm going to be talking to two people from two separate groups within the spiritual world, although they do overlap into others, that have had a very powerful relationship of, you could say, mutual admiration and engagement that's really fascinated me. It's really inspired me. The first group are those involved with integral theory, founded by Ken Wilber. And the second are those involved with evolutionary enlightenment, founded by Andrew Cohen. Now, if you know these guys and you know what I'm talking about, then we're going to have some fun and you're going to enjoy. But if you're in the second camp, let's say, maybe just on the edge, and sort of know their work, but not quite. And when I said their names, maybe a part of you said, yeah, I know their stuff. Then I would really invite you to take another look and just listen in a little closely, because I believe that unless you're fairly grateful for some truly compelling, progressive ideas about spiritual development and enlightenment that have come from these individuals and their teams that actually translate into absolute hands-on daily application, then I guarantee you may be missing something quite profound, something that at the very least can enhance what you're already doing in your practice. And if you're in the third camp and know nothing about these guys, then you're in for a treat. Next Tuesday, at the same time, I'm going to be talking with the evolutionary of the two, Mike Wambacher. He's the author of 11 Days at the Edge. And this is the sort of book that I just love because it's one he wrote on retreat with Andrew Cohen, or about a retreat. He didn't write it while he was on retreat. And it's basically a tell-all as he dives into the absolute pit of his own personal ego with all the trimmings. Barbara Marx Hubbard calls it epic in scope and purpose, which is not too shabby a review. I'm sure you'll agree. So I would really advise you to check that out and us next Tuesday if you can. Tonight, however, I'm privileged to welcome the integral theorist of the two. He's the Director of Integral Affairs at the World Council of Religious Leaders. He also serves as Educational Director of the Center for World Spirituality in San Francisco. He's the author of two books, Developmental Religious Pluralism, An Introduction to Integral Religious Studies, and The Heart of Conscious Evolution Towards a Model of Spiritual Development for an Integral Age. Both books will be out later this year. He's been a close student of integral philosopher Ken Wilber since 2004, currently practices in the lineage streams of Mahamudra and Dzogchen under the guidance of Daniel P. Brown, received his undergraduate degree from Cornell, and is currently pursuing a master's of liberal arts and religion at Harvard. You can find out more about his work and go to integralreligion.org. Dustin DePerna, my God, what an introduction. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much, Zachary. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So to start, I think you'd mentioned to me that you wanted to maybe set the mood for a moment.
Absolutely. I'd be very honored to do that.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you.
Please do. So, take the floor.
Sure. So all those who are listening, as long as you're in a safe place, it's important that we approach tonight's topic just like we would any other spiritual topic. We can approach the cognitive inquiry into integral theory with a sort of spiritual reverence. So if we could, we'll just start by closing our eyes. And if I could have everybody just take a nice deep breath in and full exhale out. Now, all of us are probably listening to this call for a variety of reasons. So in your own mind, in your own awareness, as you sit here and as you let your awareness relax, just simply set your own personal intention for our time together. This can be a secret intention. No one else needs to know it, just you. Setting an intention for our conversation and an intention for the entire dialogue. Good. Continuing to let your mind relax. And then taking one more inhale in and fully exhaling out, as if you're breathing your intention into the universe. Good. And then as we engage together, you can gently open your eyes And instead of just listening with your ears, as you might be used to, see if you can listen with the whole front surface of your body. So even if you're listening on headphones or over a radio or internet, just let the front surface of your body open as if your heart is listening, as if your shoulders are listening and your belly is listening. So whole body attention, whole body listening. Okay, great. Thank you, Zachary. Thanks for letting me set that up.
Oh, my. Thank you, Dustin. That's actually the first time that anyone has sort of done something like that with me at the beginning of an interview, and I feel so much better, but I also feel like I just want to kick up my heels and just go deeper. So I'm going to see if we can do both.
Yeah, well, there's no question that we can probably do both together.
Yeah, and maybe kick off with something that I believe came out of evolutionary enlightenment with Andrew Cohen, something that the integral theorists and the evolutionaries are really doing. And in a way, by setting the space that you just have now, you sort of entered into it as well, and you brought all the rest of us with you. And it's this we space, this sort of transpersonal communal we space that a lot of these groups, and mind you, the audience, you know, if you're interested in this as we continue to go forward, there's a fantastic group that does it in New York. They call Evolutionary Enlightenment in the City, and they're doing just this. But could you just explain a little bit about it, Dustin, and your experience of it?
Sure, happy to. And I'll just start off by just indicating that there are slight differences in the ways that someone from an integral perspective might talk about this versus someone from an Evolutionary Enlightenment perspective. So just to preface that at the beginning, I'll be coming from that integral perspective. So when we talk about an evolutionary we space, the first thing that we need to understand is that in our day-to-day life, we're often coming from a perspective that's contracted, that's embedded in our own individual ego or sense of separate self. And that what the history of religious traditions and spiritual traditions have taught us is that we can actually transcend this limited sense of self to a more expansive, embracing sense of self. So even before we start to talk about an evolutionary we space, we have to understand that we're setting up the intention for that through our individual personal practice. So step one of any evolutionary we space is to gain some bit of transcendence from your individual separate self. Now, as a second step, something that the integral theorists of past, and particularly Ken Wilber and others, have really emphasized is this capacity that we also have to engage in the world. So we're not only taking an ascending perspective of deeper realization, but we're also engaging in the world. Now, because that engagement in the world necessarily has to come through our particular individual vehicles and our particular individual personalities, there's a certain way in which that perspective, although the transcendent perspective might be the same, the perspective that comes through will be unique. And this is something that Rabbi Mark Gaffney, another member of the integral community, calls the unique self. So true self or realization plus the unique perspective through which that individual realization comes is unique self. Now, with the realization of unique self in the world, there's the foundation for what we might call an evolutionary we. So when we engage in a collective of individuals, and we actually say that as I take my realization, bring it through a unique perspective, and then engage with other people who are doing the same, we recognize that although a transcendent perspective is the same, that agentic or individual perspective is unique. So we come together into higher forms of collaboration because we have what we sometimes call a unique we, or there's unique selves that have come together into unique configuration of intersubjective space. Okay, so that's the foundation for kind of this evolutionary we, if we want to just have the theoreticals set forth. But I would love, if it's okay with you, Zachary, to go into a little bit of detail about what this is actually like in real time, rather than simply talking about the theoretics or the conceptual models that back it up. Would that be okay?
Yeah, I would love you to. That's exactly where I wanted to go.
Yeah, fantastic. So I'll just speak to my own personal experience of what's been happening with some of my fellow spiritual practitioners, because I think there's a lot of juice here for the potential of where we could go with spiritual practice in the future. So a group of friends and I, we began to engage together in deep meditative practice and intersubjective engagement. We'd get up at 4 in the morning, we'd spend a couple hours practicing. And what began to happen over time is that after we'd finished meditating, coming from this deeply expansive place, when we engaged together afterwards, there was this feeling like we were all still totally individuals, and we had embraced this kind of deeper, higher perspective, but there was this new evolutionary emergent that we could feel. It was as if the collective energy of the group had its own sense of intelligence. And what we began to do over time, and one time in particular when this arose for the first time, it was literally as if our individual awarenesses all joined in an energy field that rested above our heads, and it felt as if it was the energy field of the we, and then we began to speak from the we as opposed to speaking from ourselves, from our individual perspectives. Now, I know just speaking about that flippantly sounds maybe a little strange, but I can tell you this was, you know, as a spiritual practitioner for over a decade now, this was by far and away the most extraordinary spiritual experience of my entire life, because it included all the classic spiritual kind of realizations, or the sense of vast kind of interconnectivity, a sense of kind of non-dual awareness, but at the same time, it also included the unique perspectives of each of us and this perspective that maybe we could actually look from the we as opposed to from the I. And all we kept thinking about was the level of intimacy that this created. It was like we had joined together into a new level of self-organization, as if boundaries had kind of dropped around us. And we had dreams and thoughts about what this would mean for the future, for cooperation, for coordination, all the ways that if more people could start functioning from a collective we that totally preserves agency but also joins in communion, we're blown away by the potential it could hold. So maybe that gives a little taste, and I'm happy to take any of that deeper that you wish.
Yeah, I'm just so glad that you paused at that particular point, because it's a mammoth point to say that suddenly an emergent we identity came about through this ongoing practice. I mean, what you're talking about in a way, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about a collective enlightenment in a way, like the emergence of I guess how Ken Wilber might call it, a sort of an emergent holon, the next level of enlightenment from the individual to a group. And I mean, that's incredibly pioneering.
Yeah, and there's some, you know, obviously important distinctions that we need to make, because there's, you know, individual holons and social holons or collective holons, and we don't want to conflate those two. But there certainly was this interesting new emergent that we really felt like was just at the edge of conscious exploration. And it's precisely what you said. There were certain ways in which this was extraordinary. This was a collective form of awakening that we hadn't experienced before. And one of the things that we spoke about as these continue to, I mean, this arose much more than once. I think we've now, in a sense, each time we get together, we can feel some bit of this collective we or this higher we. But one of the things that really stands out is the ways in which the individual may have historically always been able to awaken. And individuals who are awake have probably always been getting together in collectives. But this felt like there was something new, there was something different, because it wasn't just awake individuals that was coming together, and this is the important point. It was the fact that there was a new sense of identity that arose that was dependent on each of our agentic engagements. So historically, perhaps there were certain times in which people would kind of give up their individual selves to some kind of collective. We sometimes call this conformist consciousness or traditional consciousness. But the key distinction here was that all of our individual unique kind of agentic qualities were entirely preserved, yet they were transcended and included in this communal collective we. So it was as if agency and communion were functioning both simultaneously, and in fact, each were mutually enhanced.
Hmm. Yeah, it's extraordinary. And as you know, as you say it, I keep thinking one of my longest bones to pick with just spiritual in general is I always sort of considered a bit like the separation of church and state, in the fact that it was the separation of practice and life. Mm. And very often we would do our practice, and then in life we would, you know, and there was always this attempt to say, you know, if you practice in the morning and then in the evening, you're slowly trying to have it bleed through to connect ultimately in the middle of the day so that you have an ongoing flow. But what you're talking about, you know, certainly in a community or amongst friends or among people you work with, I mean, do tell me, is that bleeding ability seems to be shifted into an entirely new level?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a couple comments to make to say just off the bat about that bleeding ability, or what you call it, this kind of continuation of awareness might be an appropriate way to call it. So the capacity to take meditation practice off the mat and to bring it into everyday life is something that's certainly well established in the tradition. So that aspect isn't necessarily new. But what is new is this idea that we're engaging together. And if we know one thing, we know that the global problems that we face today aren't problems that any one individual is going to solve. They're problems that need to be faced collectively by huge groups of people working together. So I think the most exciting piece is not only that we're bringing our meditation awareness off the mat into moment-to-moment reality, but it's the fact that we found some kind of key to collective engagement. Because what happens in this we space is that it's almost as if we feel as if we're a single organism working towards a similar goal or a similar end. And because we feel like each of us is simply an arm or a leg of the same organism, the coordination, the cooperation, the intimacy, the trust that's established is unlike anything else. And I think if nothing else, that quality in itself could be one of the saving qualities of our current human predicament. Because working together is going to be one of the solutions to all the problems that we face.
Yeah, Dustin. As we talk, there's so many different ways we can take this conversation for the small amount of time we have. So I'm really just racking my brains for the best possible, highest way we can take it. Mm-hmm. I with that in mind, I did want to ask you just to touch upon, and actually, let me just say to the audience, if anyone is interested in these sort of engagements. I'll give some details at the end. There are groups, certainly in New York City, certainly on the East Coast, on the West Coast, and we'll give details about that at the end if you're interested, because it really is pioneering work and definitely something you should at least check out before you're ready to dismiss it. And Dustin, I want to just ask you just about the Enlighten Next and an integral relationship, how
sure.
These two groups have come together. And I'm really interested in that because I've been always a passionate advocate of linking arms, and I think now more than ever we're looking at the new age, and it's just it's a gigantic melting pot, and there's a lot of I think everybody on this call, I don't even need to say any more, we know what we're talking about when we look at the new age. It's really everything from A to Z, and when you see two really powerful organizations coming together and really making a stand together more than I would say almost any other, and certainly in the new age, quote unquote, community, it's definitely saying something, and I'd love to know your thoughts on that.
Sure. It's a fantastic question, because I think that if we're not walking the talk, if we're not actually coordinating and cooperating amongst each other, then we're not really doing what we say is needed. So, my initial impetus to connect with the Enlightened Next community was inspired by the Guru and Pandit dialogues that Ken Wilber and Andrew Cohen have been doing for quite some time now through What is Enlightenment magazine, or what is now called eNext magazine. For those of you who aren't familiar with it and not familiar with Ken and Andrew, Andrew is a spiritual teacher who considers himself a guru, and Ken Wilber is a philosopher who considers himself a pandit or a pundit. And there were certain ways in which I saw the spark between the two of them. And, in the integral community, there was for a long time hesitation about Andrew Cohen's community and the Enlightened Next community. There were certain ways in which people had critiques and things they didn't think were as full or as integral or as wholesome as maybe they could be. And, what happened is I moved to Boston for graduate school, and I began to connect with people in the Enlightened Next community. And person after person, there was something that struck me about the kind of dignity that each of the students held. And
yeah.
as I engaged more with this level of dignity and uprightness, I began to realize that some of the stereotypes or even misconceptions that I had coming from an integral community about some of the Enlightened Next community, and the more I engaged, the more impressed I was. And what began to happen over time is I realized that just like the integral community has things that they can offer to other communities, particularly some of its models and some of its distinctions about how to exist in a modern or postmodern world, I began to learn that the Enlightened Next community had particular technologies that the Interscope community didn't have. And some of those technologies really revolved around this collective engagement, this collective enlightenment piece, this we space piece. And so what began to happen is that through my connections, my collaborations, it was almost as if I was serving as a spiritual diplomat between communities. I would bring ideas from the integral community in. I would engage and entice and kind of challenge ideas in the Enlightened Next community. But simultaneously, I would bring everything that I learned from the Enlightened Next community to folks in the integral community. So this kind of cross-pollination, it's bearing so much fruit, and it continues to be truly an extraordinary experience. So I would say that this kind of trans-traditional bridge building, or the kind of recognizing the multi-dimensions and multi-centers of integral consciousness that it begins to emerge, the more that we can link up those various spheres, those various social holons, the better off we will be to have a more holistic or comprehensive solution to tomorrow's problems, today's problems.
Yeah, I agree. And I found the same thing about that community. I've seen a lot of communities in my short time on Earth, and you know, it's always something. It's always an interesting dichotomy between the teacher and the community. And I definitely found something a little different with certainly the evolutionary community. I know them a lot more than I know the integral community, but it was definitely something that sort of caught my eye, looking from one to the other. And you're sort of waiting, because I think I speak for so many of us in the New Age. You know, we love it, and we move around, but we're constantly turning around and going, God, everyone's so weird. Everyone's so strange, you know? They've always got something that's sort of some piece of something that they're working on that's right on the edge of their sleeve. But with the community we're talking about, you know, they're really holding their pants up.
Yeah.
As my wife would say, you know, they're really holding that line firmly.
That's true. And the very thing is true with the integral community in general is that there's something that's entirely normal in the most positive sense of the way, that the integral community is actually, in some ways, I like to describe everybody in the integral community as these undercover spiritual agents in the world. And that no one, if you saw someone on the street, you wouldn't peg them as woo-woo or New Age. They're entirely, entirely normal people who have found a way to engage spirituality in the rational world, in the postmodern world, in a way that kind of meets all the critiques and legitimizes spirituality. So just a second what you say, I really think the same thing is true within the integral community.
Yeah. Now I want to sort of take a moment and slowly move into some of your work, which I'm interested in, which is to do with religion and interfaith dialogue, and perhaps even, you know, the sort of the summum bonum of perhaps the final end to religious wars and all of that, you know, however many years into the future. But I want to maybe ask you to give us just an idea of some of the main integral points, just for anyone who might not be entirely schooled on what we're talking about, so that then we can, you know, dive into your particular area and maybe carry some of those with us.
Right. I think that's a fantastic idea. So a lot of times the easiest place to start is just to look at some of the research that we've gained over the past few years through the psychological traditions and others. And, for example, there's a researcher named Howard Gardner who came out with a book in the early 80s named Frames of Mind. And in that book, he coined an idea called multiple intelligences. And this is intuitive to most people. It's the basic idea that we have various areas of intelligence that all grow at different rates. One way to look at this is to say that obviously we have IQ, and that historically lots of the standardized tests that we take kind of try to assess that IQ. Another area of growth is emotional intelligence. So Daniel Goleman, who's another researcher out of Harvard, and another gentleman named Richard Boyatzis, came up with a model of emotional intelligence to show that IQ and EQ both help people navigate the world, and that neither one is necessarily more important or more fundamental, but both are important. A few years later, another gentleman named James Fowler developed a model of faith development, or what sometimes could be called spiritual intelligence. And it's this area of spiritual intelligence that a lot of my work is focused. And when we speak about any of these areas, emotional intelligence, IQ, EQ, or spiritual intelligence, what's sometimes called SQ. One of the first things we learn is that there isn't just one version of it, but that each of these lines of development move through stages of development. So lines of development move through stages or structures of development. And one of the easiest ways to think about structural development is that at the lowest versions of structural development, people take more of an egocentric view. That means that their sphere of embrace doesn't extend beyond themselves. And at the second stage of development, people move to what's sometimes called an ethnocentric worldview. That means that they've gone beyond taking the perspective of just themselves and can now take the perspective and embrace with care those of their same social group, those in their family, those who might believe in the same religious tradition as them. So we see that that's a positive step forward in evolution, to move from egocentric to ethnocentric. The next step, we sometimes say, is that people move from ethnocentric to worldcentric. And this simply means that I can take care of myself, and I do that. I take care of my family and embrace my family and their perspectives and my worldview. But then I move to a place where, on a world-centric level, I take perspectives of all human beings, regardless of their race, regardless of their class, regardless of their religious tradition, regardless of if I have any familial connection with them. So we see that's also a step forward, move from egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric. So a lot of my work has looked at the various ways that our religious traditions can, through spiritual intelligence, move from ethnocentric worldviews to world-centric worldviews. And the models I use are a bit more complex than that. I use 5 or 6 levels of development normally when I write and teach about this. But you get the general idea that there's ethnocentric versions of each tradition and there's world-centric versions of each tradition. So we can say that there's an ethnocentric version of Christianity and a world-centric version of Christianity. There's also an ethnocentric version of Islam and a world-centric version of Islam. Another way to think about these same developmental levels is to use a metric of something like traditional to rational to pluralistic to integral. And these tend to be the models that I use. So if we just set aside the model of egocentric, ethnocentric, world-centric, and use the model of traditional, rational, pluralistic, and integral, we see that there's not just one interpretation of our world's religious traditions, but there's actually these 4 or 5 interpretations of religious tradition. There's a traditional interpretation of Christianity. There's a rational interpretation of Christianity. There's a pluralistic or postmodern interpretation of Christianity and an integral version. And, of course, there will be future levels that evolve that transcend and include precisely the level that might be the leading edge today. And so a lot of my work, above all else, at least in this first book that I've written, the book that you mentioned called Developmental Religious Pluralism, it speaks about the ways that a developmental understanding of religious interpretation can actually bring significant amount of clarity to things like religious dialogue, to things like people's own relationship to their tradition. But I think more importantly, it shows people that there are rational interpretations of religion that can actually coincide and agree with science. Because a lot of times what happens is that we take a traditional version of religion that's based on belief and dogma, sometimes what we call a pre-rational interpretation, and then we compare that to science that's based on evidence, and of course we see this clash between science and religion. But when we take a rational version of a religious tradition and compare it to rational science, we actually see that they coincide and that there's no conflict. So I think ultimately, not only does this help people with their personal life and does it help people with their relationship to religion, and it shows us how we can actually have science and religion coincide without too much trouble. So that's kind of book one. And I'm happy to go into some of my other work that, for me, it gets so interesting because you can take all of these ideas and we can begin to speak about the ways that the integral model can inform spiritual realization. So book one is more about the ways in which we can look at religion through these different lenses. Book two is more about the nuances of spiritual realization, including some of this unique we stuff that you mentioned. And together, both of these books are collectively called Volume 1 and Volume 2 of Integral Religious Studies. So I'll pause there. I know that was a mouthful.
No, I want to keep diving in, but I also just want to take a moment and say I feel like I'm I'm hearing in the ether the question, you know, people must be thinking, well, first of all, this is a very dicey subject you're dealing with, obviously. Religion, we know. I mean, one of the diciest, if not the diciest. So I would ask, you know, when I sit down, and once again, I'd encourage anyone who's interested in Ken Wilber's work to take the easy road and just go to Sounds True and just pay, you know, $50 for a 12-hour interview with him and Tammy Simon. And, I mean, unless you've got a metal plate in your head, you know, his Buddha belly is just going to bump you into another level of development just through sitting through 10 hours. But my question is, how, you know, I think intuitively, which is what's so wonderful about Integral, is that intuitively people already understand a lot of these things. And when Integral comes along, it's like this gigantic map that just, boom, falls down to the table, and everything becomes clear. And my question is, if you're dealing with, you know, obviously religion, you're dealing with rational and traditional and pluralistic all at once, how do you even approach what I think Integral really euphemistically calls traditional believers?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the dicey part. How do you approach that on the ground? I feel like a lot of people might say, well, these are great theories, but how do you do that?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And I think that the starting place is love. And when we actually speak to people that are coming from a traditional level of consciousness, and we explain to them that there are certain ways in which increasing levels of development also equal increasing levels of care and capacity. So we show people someone that's coming from a traditional level of development that may be ethnocentric, thinking that my tradition is the only correct tradition, and people who don't believe in my tradition are not saved, will go to hell, or can't be awake. I think the best place in with any of those folks is just to explain the fact, and this, of course, happens over time, and people need to take their own developmental paths, and we, of course, honor the fact that any station of development is appropriate and it's valid. But if you focus on the idea that increasing levels of development also equal increasing capacities for love, you at least get some people to listen. You at least get people with an open mind to kind of embrace ideas that might otherwise be a little intimidating or might feel too heady. And I think that if nothing else, that's the place that we start. We talk about how higher levels of development equal greater and greater capacities for embrace, for love, and for perspective taking. Of course, people won't change overnight, and of course, the goal isn't necessarily to get everybody into the highest level the fastest we can, but it's to build in healthy systems so that when people are ready, they know that if they want to move from a traditional to a rational level of development, we need them to know that it's a legitimate form of their religion. So one of the first things that we're doing is working with people, religious leaders from around the globe, to help explain to them that if someone's ready to make that transition from a mythic belief-based tradition, version of, say, Christianity or Islam or Buddhism, that we can also provide a rational version of that tradition, and we can also provide a pluralistic version of that tradition. So the goal is to make people not only set the conditions to help them evolve through the traditions, but also to make them healthy wherever they are. So as long as that's taken into consideration, and when we add to that this element of love and just explaining to people, just to have them be open-minded, that we're trying to teach them ways that we can increase love or we can increase capacity for care. And there's normally a window that at least the conversation can get started. And as long as we're coming from it from an orientation that isn't in any way condescending, but instead is radically embracing and accepting of where the person is, while simultaneously acknowledging that higher levels also include more reality than lower levels, then I think that that's a good place to start.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. I thought I had you with that question, Dustin, and then you came out with love, and you just completely deflated my approach. But I completely agree. I really do, and I think I agree with what you're saying. Something I want to keep asking you in the general direction of is, you know, obviously the future of religion. And for a long time, I used to think that 1,000 years from now, we'd have a sort of a global binary religion, and everyone would agree on a sort of non-denominational religion that was very you know, sort of futuristic and minimalist, like a Zen temple or something. And now obviously I think that's completely wrong, and everything, all of the great traditions are going to be preserved, hopefully, because we're such a wonderful, you know, array on this planet. But that ultimately there may be something like a sort of global religious secret handshake or non-secret handshake, that everyone agrees that ultimately there is, you know, just spirit, but that, like Everest, you can take so many different angles of the mountain to get to the top. So what's your take on that and the future of religion?
Sure. I mean, that's, again, you're bringing such fascinating questions. The first thing to understand is that everybody is born into the world at square one. That means that they're born into the world at the lowest levels of development. It means that everybody will necessarily have to move through egocentric, ethnocentric, worldcentric, or even cosmocentric worldviews, and you can't really skip stages. So once we understand that, we understand that people who are raised within religious traditions, we understand that it's a natural progress for people to move through each of those stages. So that's part one. If that is the case, and if that is true, and our development research into developmental psychology says that it is, then that means that, as you said, the traditions are never going to go away. That means that the religious traditions will always be filled up with people from different developmental levels. And ultimately, I think that's a good thing because it preserves diversity. But when we think about the future of the religion, we also ask the question, so what's happening at those highest levels of development? And something begins to happen as we move into a world-centric level of development. We agree that, yes, you know, we're still members of our original tradition, and maybe that means that our original religious tradition is secular humanism. We're not just talking about the religious traditions that people normally consider, so my tradition might be secular humanism. But then I might move into a space that we sometimes call translineage, and that space is one in which we say, I'm still a member of my tradition, but I'm also beyond it somehow. I'm also in a world space where I know the importance of the lineage, and I don't want to get rid of it, but I also want to engage with others in a space that's unique, in a space that's kind of that transcends and includes the traditions. So I think when we talk about future of religion, one of the keys is to understanding that any form of global spirituality that might emerge will be one in which, A, the traditions are preserved through ethnocentric and world-centric and cosmocentric levels, but B will be one that the highest levels are engaging in a translineage space in which the basic deep structures of the religious traditions can be agreed upon and enacted. So that's, I think, a good place to start. But I can certainly keep going because this is something that I spend hours and hours and hours a day pondering. So if you're interested, there's a direction that I'd like to take it.
Let me ask a question, and then I'll just let you decide, because I feel exactly the same way. And my question was, as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, ultimately, and let's just dream for a second, you know, at the point in history when all religious intolerance and all religious wars cease, and suddenly, you know, that sort of morphogenetic field of interfaith acceptance becomes solidified. As you were talking about that, I this sort of came across my head, and I suddenly started thinking about the we space on a massive level.
Yeah.
And so I'd say, what happens to religion at that point? Because that's a tipping point right there. I mean, that's a, you know what I mean?
I'm tracking what you're saying completely. So the first thing I'll say is, it's uncertain whether or not these this is a caveat, uncertain or not whether or not the ethnic and religious kind of battles will ever end, because there will always be people at ethnocentric levels of development. So just as a little side note, caveat that, put it to the side. The more interesting question is the one that you just brought up. And that's the idea is, what happens at this level of development where people are acting in a translineage space, but then enacting this evolutionary we? And I think that is where the juice is, because I think that is the future of our planet. So what I imagine is a world federation of some sort that is a higher level of self-organization that kind of corrects all the various problems that people have cited about the United Nations. So some kind of collective federation that transcends and includes the United Nations, or in some way reorients the United Nations. And I imagine that world federation being composed of an economic sphere to take care of economic interests, a political sphere, to take care of political and social and civic interests, and a spiritual sphere or a religious sphere. I consider these, and those I work with at the World Council of Religious Leaders, we consider these the three pillars of society: religion or spirituality, economics, and politics. If we can develop a world federation that includes each of these bodies, then I can imagine the world in which the evolutionary we space becomes the new driving force that guides the planet. And in this field, it would be as if we're not electing officials into these spheres to the degree to which they have the right education or the degree to which they're the right funders, but we're electing them into that space to the degree to which they can open up to this evolutionary we space. And to me, it just seems, it makes sense that as we as a planet begin to engage as a we, that means we begin to speak as a we, as a planet. That makes so much sense to me that the next step, that's a prerequisite for any kind of larger collaboration on a larger scale beyond our single planet. So if in fact it's true that there's anything else out in the universe, anything beyond our own particular life system, if there's something like a Star Wars Galactic Federation of some sort, the only way that we'd be able to engage in that, it'd be the prerequisite for engaging in any kind of intergalactic collaboration, would be that we can speak as a planet, as a we, as an I, with one voice. And to me, that gets exciting, and that could be thousands and thousands of years into the future. It could be much sooner than that. But I do think that there's exciting juice when we start to talk about evolutionary we space as a planet, because I do think that's the future where we're headed.
It's tremendously exciting what you're saying. Just listening to you say those things just brought the hair up on the back of my neck. Well, I was going to ask you, and feel free to take it any which way you like, just on the practical side, where do you see, because I have a real hobby of just looking over at the landscape, you know, across the board, as difficult as it is to sort of hold it all at once. You know, you've got, you know, New Age, spirituality, religion, then the sort of illusion of separation between state, then you got foundations and NGOs and nonprofits and sort of everything that's going around there, and places like the Council on World Religions and some of the organizations that you're involved with. Those are the ones that I'm always looking at. And when I see, obviously, an Enlightened Next and an Integral Institute forging a link, you know, there suddenly I see, something's building there, you know. So looking over the landscape that you're involved with and the scope of your vision, do you see any movement? What do you see, any potential trends? And who are some of the people who are really doing fantastic work? I mean, including the ones you're working with. And where do you see movements in the future? And if so, what kind?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I see movements in the future. I think that there's, you know, my evolutionary optimism is strong, and it's optimism and idealism with a dose of realism. So I definitely understand that the path in the future is not going to be easy, and it takes a lot of individual responsibility and collective commitment to something higher than ourselves. But the trend, the overall trend with all the people that I'm interacting with, both here in the States and internationally, the trend is towards higher levels of self-transcendence into greater levels of collaboration collectively. And the ways in which the world system has now opened to the spiritual traditions of the world, in the sense that we now have access to the best teachings that have ever existed and the most secret teachings that have ever existed, from the Hindu Tantric tradition to the Tibetan Buddhist tradition to Kabbalah and the various esoteric Christian traditions. There's a certain way in which these ideas are flooding our intellectual neurosphere, or our intellectual marketplace, in a way that is catalyzing levels of transformation that I think have never been seen before. So with that said, I do also think that there's a lot of interesting things happening intergenerationally. Some of the ways that I like to think about this is that, at least from the Western perspective and here in the States, there was a certain way in which there were two streams that came out of the 1960s, that glorious hippie revolution. One of those streams was a stream of spirituality, and we see that with leaders like Ram Dass and the various followers of Neem Karoli Baba in India, and the great leaders of that baby boomer generation that went out and brought these spiritual teachings back from the East and embedded them in the West. But there was a second stream that came out of the 60s, and that second stream was the stream of social action and the stream of kind of a proud stance for human rights and for doing what's best in the world for the sake of the whole. And today, there's a really interesting trend happening, and as I step back and look at it, it just blows me away. And that's that I see these two worldviews coming together. And as we know quite well, spirituality by itself isn't necessarily that useful. You could end up in certain ways being a spiritual monk or nun and be in a cave and live there for the rest of your life, and your spiritual life could be fulfilled. And on the other side of the street, there's this social active impulse, but on the downside, the social active impulse often leads to burnout because people don't have the spaciousness to handle all the pain and suffering that they know is existing in the world. But what's happening now is this trend of those two traditions coming together where people have the spiritual realization to, as Ken says, things hurt more but they bother you less. You can actually hold more in your awareness. You can hold more pain, more suffering. And on the other side of the street, we have people who are still engaging in social action. So when we bring these two together, we have people who are fully awake, who can handle anything, but won't suffer burnout as they engage in the world and make the world a better place. So it's these two streams from the 60s that I think the generation above us, this baby boomer generation, is now passing down to us. I think it's the integration of those two streams that we really find a lot of excitement. So that's one trend that I see happening that I think is keeping me very evolutionarily optimistic.
Wow, yeah, that's great. I hadn't seen that at all, actually, or in very, very small parts, but the fact that you're saying it is opening me up to the things that may have been in my awareness but not necessarily in my attention. So that's very encouraging. That's fantastic. We have a few more minutes, and I think I've got just time to squeeze in one more question for you. And then I'd really like to just give people a couple of areas where maybe they can go and poke their noses in and see what we're talking about and judge for themselves, because that's where you know, the rubber really hits the road. And I think it's important that people have places to go. That's always a key for me, rather than just a sort of nebulous conversation over the airwaves. And my final question, we really just have a few more minutes. It was, I think I spoke to you a little bit about this when we were talking on the phone before the interview a few days ago. And it was about the engagement of, you know, the spiritual public. Because I've had the honor of working with a spiritual public for a while. And I see two things in particular. I see a lot of people who are still desperately involved in spirituality, wanting it so badly, but they still have their day jobs that they're very frustrated with. You know, they're other undercover spiritual people where they're sort of selling their souls on one part, and yet, you know, when they get home at night, they're giving their souls back. You know, they're taking it back. And then the spiritual event, and this is a gigantic question, so you're just going to have to pull something really special out, Dustin. I'm just going to put you on the spot like that. The second part of it is the spiritual event, and I felt for the longest time that it's ever so slowly becoming a little redundant, just the format of it, that's to say. And so someone who's really, you know, got huge excitement and fantastic ideas and really sort of coming up with a lot of great new concepts, I want to know, what do you think about in terms of the public, the people who are there listening to you or listening to me or listening to anyone, listening to Ken or Andrew, and what levels of engagement can they involve themselves in, not just as someone who pays a monthly fee to get access to a website or not just someone who goes on a call, but how do you see a way that this can evolve into the future where there can be more involvement at a better level?
Yeah. Gosh, great question. And it's big.
Yeah.
I'd say that there's two parts to it. So there's two parts to it that I want to just focus on as we kind of wind down our time. The first is that meditation or some sort of spiritual discipline in your daily life can allow one to kind of transcend this sense of separate self into a place that's deeply content. And the degree to which we do that will allow us no matter what we do, no matter where we are, it will allow us to be more pleasant to be around and maybe even enhance other people's lives. So step one of engagement is making sure that you have your own personal practice. Step two, and this gets into the kind of the realm of the virtual. So, you know, many of us live in communities where maybe some of us don't know other people who are engaging this sort of spirituality. Others, you know, those that live in maybe New York or San Francisco or Boulder, have a sense of community, and they're engaging people face-to-face. But I think what the future really holds is this capacity to engage using Internet technologies, and not just, you know, message boards and rooms like that, but using technologies like Skype, where we begin to host collectives of people remotely. So people literally kind of beam into collective sanghas or to collective groups in order to engage in this kind of practice. And I already see that happening. It's happening among my groups here. It's happening where we can have conversations with someone in Brussels, another person who's in Amsterdam, a person in Germany, a person in New York, a person in San Francisco. So I think there's certain ways in which technology or things like the Internet and these new emergent kind of video technologies will actually become the new forms of engagement, because what happens is that people of these kind of higher developmental levels often find themselves alone. And the way that we're going to start connecting is through this kind of intersubjective virtual space. So step one is meditation. Step two is engaging with others virtually through that kind of technology, because people are out there. You can engage in sites like Integral Life. You can sign up for my mailing list, and I can certainly direct you to groups like that are happening. Here in San Francisco, we have the Center for World Spirituality, where we have a gathering, you know, the first Saturday of every month, plus retreats and other things like that. There's tons of ways to engage. Center for World Spirituality, you can join by webcast every Saturday, or the first Saturday of every month. I think that there's going to be ways in which there's no excuse anymore to say that you can't practice with people, that you can't engage with communities, because the technology is there. And even if you don't have access to a computer, finding a local library or a place that does have access is the wave of the future. Obviously, that physical embodiment is going to be our top priority, but we no longer can make excuses for not engaging into these collective forms. So I encourage everybody that if anybody has questions about that sort of thing, please feel free to send them my way, and I can direct you guys. And I myself am also, I host groups like that. So if anybody's interested in getting together to do a 10-person or a 20-person or even a 5-person gathering through things like Skype, we'll go to whatever limits that these online chat rooms or online video rooms can handle. So happy to offer that as well.
Wow, that's fantastic. I could go on a lot longer about that, Dustin, but I think we're just out of time. And I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been really interesting. I always know when I'm fascinated by something, because I completely forget everything that I had planned to talk about, and only what's spontaneous seems to come. So I really thank you from the bottom of my heart. And for anyone who's interested in anything we've spoken about, you can go to enlightennext.org for the evolutionary elements. You can go to soundstrue.com for that interview with Ken Wilber, which is, I guarantee you, probably the best audio interview I've ever heard in my life. You can also go to integralnaked.org. You can find Dustin's work on integralreligion.org. You can also email me at zedelef@gmail.com, and I can direct you to any of the things that we've spoken about this evening. Dustin, thank you so much.
Zachary, thank you so very, very much. It was such a pleasure to be here. And I'll just say one more time, There's also the Center for World Spirituality.com. That is a fantastic place to engage. We're hosting world events in Hungary, in Japan, here in San Francisco. We'll be doing other things all around the globe. So stay engaged. We might be coming somewhere near you.
Great. Okay. Take care, Justin.
Thank you so much.
Bye. My pleasure. Bye.